Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
Hello and welcome to the Folklore Podcast. I'm Mark Norman, folklore researcher and author. If you're listening to this episode on the day that it's released, 18th of August, then you can join me in celebrating the birthday of the late Jerron Criswell King, better known to fans of Ed Wood movies as The Amazing Criswell. He was born on this day in 1907. The Amazing Criswell also predicted that the world would end on this day in 1999. As far as we can tell, it didn't. And this fact neatly summarises the accuracy of most of this American psychic's predictions. Criswell told many stories about himself. He declared that he'd not spoken until the age of 4, when, as a thunderstorm raged outside the house, he suddenly declared, making his first prediction, that the rain would stop. He claimed to sleep in a coffin. In his 1968 book, Criswell Predicts From Now to the Year 2000, he predicted that Denver, Colorado would be struck by a ray from space, which would turn all metal into rubber and cause terrible accidents in theme parks. We don't think this happened either. Or the prediction about mass cannibalism. In today's episode of the podcast, Hilary Wilson sorts the truth from the fiction in Criswell's colourful life as she chats with author Edwin Lee Canfield. Edwin has spent the last 20 years, yes, 20 years, researching Criswell's life, conducting numerous interviews with people who knew him, worked with him, or were related to him. His book, Fact, Fictions and the Forbidden Predictions of the Amazing Criswell, may be considered the definitive reference on Criswell.
Hi, this is Hilary Wilson here for the Folklore Podcast today. Today I'm going to be talking to Edwin Lee Canfield about his book, Fact, Fiction and the Forbidden Predictions of the Amazing Criswell, which is out now through a Head Press, assuming it's not yet again sold out. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Hilary. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so you spent over 2 decades doing research for this book. How did you first come across The Amazing Criswell?
Like a lot of people, it was from Ed Wood's Plan 9 from Outer Space. That, and then around that time, the Tim Burton film, Ed Wood, the biopic, came out as well, and Criswell was portrayed by Jeffrey Jones in that. And so I just had to know more about this guy. It was like something bizarre and eccentric, and I didn't, want to know more. And then a friend of mine loaned me his first book of prediction, Criswell Predicts to the Year 2000, which at this time it was about the year 2000. So his prediction for the world to end on August the 18th, 1999 had passed. So it was like he missed his big prediction there. And so I just started doing research. And my original intention was to do a biopic similar to the Tim Burton's Ed Wood. Worked on the script on that a little bit. And then I decided to go in the direction of a documentary, which never worked out as well. And so then I was like, well, I'll just do it as a book.
It's almost appropriate that it went through so many different manifestations, though, considering how varied Criswell's career had been as well.
Right, yeah, he dabbled in everything he could, in his search for fame.
Yeah, but you did so many interviews, with people for this book. Did you have trouble with, getting people for interviews?
Some, not very much. Most people were very forthcoming with information and sharing contacts and things like that. A few people were a bit reluctant. Paul Marco, who was good friends with Criswell and was in Plan 9 from Outer Space and other Ed Wood movies, he was a little reluctant. And then I never did get to interview him. I visited LA and he had passed away the day before I got there. So I didn't get to do that interview. And then there were a couple other people that felt that they were the ones that should tell Criswell's story since they personally knew him and I never had met him. So they're a bit reluctant, but I think I've covered everything pretty well, even without those.
Well, I definitely think you did, considering how many different interviews you did achieve for it. There was absolutely a wealth of information in here, and I was surprised how much you were able to find that wasn't associated with his years with Ed Wood, because I figured those would be the most thoroughly covered with the cult following that Ed Wood still has.
Sure. Yeah, and I did want to go way beyond that. I mean, I touch on it quite heavily in there, and there's some new stuff in there about his relationship with Ed Wood and that whole gang of people. But one thing that really helped was newspaper archives and just the proliferation of news, the availability of newspaper articles and being able to search thoroughly through them. When I first started on the project, I was using newspaper archives and it was hit and miss. There were some holes in the timeline and things like that. But then when I had my final go at it, I got back on newspaper archive and it was just incredible how much more information I could find. And it really helped fill in the holes and tell the bigger story of Criswell than just the Ed Wood relation.
Well, I was fascinated that within some of the newspaper articles, his name is misprinted. Was there a difficulty in finding some of them due to those misprints?
Some of it just popped up. Some of them I would look for the misprint, search that way as well, just to find that too.
Yeah, so Criswell is, best known, apart from his association with Ed Wood, as being a television psychic. Could you tell us a little about his early life and how that might have impacted how he portrayed himself later on?
Well, he was born in Princeton, Indiana on August the 18th, 1907. Grew up there, small town, had a pretty large extended family in a small town there, the Criswell family and the King family. Then after high school, he went to school in Cincinnati, pre-med, and then decided to become a teacher and got his teaching certificate there and a mistake on the teaching certificate, they left off his real last name of King and left it Criswell. And so just not to have to go through the hassle of having it redone, he stuck with Criswell on that. And that kind of started him taking that name. And then in the mid 30s, he moved to New York City and started writing there, was on radio doing financial forecasts, things like that. One of the legends claims that that's when he said, I predict at one point some stock thing, and that kind of stuck. So at the same time there in New York City, he started writing plays. He did a adaptation of Dorian Gray's picture of Dorian Gray, Oscar Wilde, and started to do off-Broadway productions as well. And just kind of another way to become famous. And that's where he met his future wife, Halo Meadows, who was also a playwright and putting on her own productions as well. They then wrote three books on how to succeed on Broadway in Tin Pan Alley, though they've had no success at all. They also were married for a very short time, a couple of years, and they were giving marriage advice as well. Really not knowing much about marriage, I not have a lot of experience with it. But and then they moved to Hollywood in 1940, started putting the play on there, Criswell started doing a column in the papers there. He also became acquainted with another astrologer named Norvell, who was in one of their productions of the Dorian Gray play. And I think that was one of the things that kind of started pushing him towards this, you know, predictions and astrology, things like that, mysticism, spiritualism. He, in the post-World War II, late 40s, he started his own spiritualist church called the Criswell Religious Foundation. And then he called it the Church of the Inner Voice as well. So that's when he started really dabbling in spiritualism, mysticism, things like that. And then he started his newspaper columns. And then he also started on radio. And then in the early 50s is when he got on local Los Angeles television with his Criswell Predicts program. So very early television where programming was, they were looking for anything to put on, pretty much.
Yeah, I found it fascinating how deep his almost obsession with Dorian Gray seemed to be over the years, because he kept redoing it and putting it on, and it didn't ever really seem to get very good reviews.
No. Yeah, but he stuck with it, and he definitely had a, he said Oscar Wilde was his favorite writer, and that you know, he definitely had a Dorian Gray obsession. His art director for his television program, she was a painter, and she painted a portrait of him. It pretty much just looks like his silhouette, you know, front shot standing at the desk in Plan 9 from Outer Space from the promotional photo. But kind of, she had it, made it kind of a Dorian Gray-ish look to it. And one of the reasons they moved to Hollywood was he wanted to be in the film adaptation, which was ended up being played by Hurd. I can't remember his name. Yes.
It was a fantastic adaptation, but it's no Criswell.
Yes, it was. No, it's not Criswell. He didn't make the cut for it. And it was that was one of his, probably one of his biggest disappointments, that he didn't get to do that.
I always found it interesting that, you know, within just about every film adaptation of Dorian Gray I've seen, he never has the blonde hair that Oscar Wilde describes in the book. Criswell would have been the one who actually had that hair.
Yes, he would, yeah.
But I found it interesting, you know, his obsession with Dorian Gray and Oscar Wilde, considering the rumors of his own sexual orientation and how that might have been almost a shorthand in a way of broadcasting that.
I would agree with that for sure. Yeah. He, you know, you could call him that he was closeted bisexual, you know, but, and like Liberace at the same time, you know, they kind of kept it hidden away. But still it was seen. It could be seen if you looked, I think.
Yeah. And it was an interesting bit of undercurrent. You know, it's not gone into too extensively, you know, within the biography, because obviously you want to, you know, keep some things personal, but it just seemed like an interesting undercurrent, especially seeing how things ended up going with Halo. You know, as time went on, there were some complications with the marriage.
Yes. She wasn't happy about it. And, speaking of the Dorian Gray portrait that was painted for him, she ended up stabbing it all the Dorian Gray style. I have photos of it. There's a big gash in it where she stabbed it with a knife in a fit of rage. And I don't believe they slept together, especially in their later years, because he slept in a coffin at night. So, and locked in his own room.
Yeah, that was such an interesting detail of him with the coffin as well. His family had a mortuary business, correct?
The Criswell side of the family is a long associated name with mortuaries, funeral services, and things like that. So it was that side of the family. He claimed that his father was a mortician, but he was actually an insurance salesman his entire life.
So a mortician in a way, just not the way that people...
Right, yeah, just a different angle on it, yeah.
He had this coffin that he slept in, and that's the coffin that you're able to see in some of the Ed Wood productions, right?
Yes, in Night of the Ghouls, which is originally called Revenge of the Dead, he introduces the movie by rising up out of the coffin and does his spiel to intro the movie there.
You know, with Ed Wood, this is how he is most known to people nowadays, because he is the one who introduces Plan 9 from Outer Space in an absolutely brilliant way, extremely memorable. And that is almost not exactly parodying, but referencing, you know, his television production, which lasted for a surprisingly long time, considering the quality of the predictions that he often gave.
Yeah, he was probably on air local Los Angeles television for close to 5 years through the from, you know, early mid 50s. But Ed, I think one of the ways that they met, he met with Ed Wood, was Ed was directing some television at the time. He was doing anything he could to get work. And he directed some episodes of the Criswell Predicts television show there in Los Angeles. And so I haven't been able to find any footage of that actual show, but from what I've seen and can, you know, imagine, is the opening of Plan 9 is just like the Criswell Predicts program would open.
And Regis Philbin worked on that show for a time, which
he did. Surprised. Well, he was just like a production assistant or something like that at the time, just starting in to get into television. And Criswell was dependent on cue cards. He, for some reason, he couldn't remember his predictions. He always had cue cards. Even on when he would appear on Johnny Carson, he'd have little 3x5 cards he would read the predictions from. But anyway, when Regis Philbin worked at the station, they would hold the cue cards back just out of sight that he could barely see them, and get him all flustered.
It would be amazing to find some footage of that. It has to exist somewhere.
It's probably somewhere, but yeah. Hopefully, you know, and one of the things that started to happen is I've had people contact me having read the book or heard about the book with more information. So, you know, it's going to keep growing from there. And, you know, maybe the television show will show up at some point.
That would be absolutely excellent. It seems like with every year, new footage is found of old silent films, you know, something that has been long thought lost. But one of the things that I thought was interesting was that he, with his newspaper column, he responded to so many people who would write in. You know, with each a publication, he would invite people to write him, and, you know, was responding to those letters. That would have taken an awful lot of time.
Yeah. He just, that was a lot. He did get overwhelmed at one point after his columns started becoming very popular, and he had to back off a little bit and take some time to catch up on the letters, and wasn't taking any new ones to respond to. And and just the number of his predictions as well. I estimate there's tens of thousands of predictions that he has done, including the newspaper columns, magazines, television, radio, you know, all the mediums that he worked in. So he was quite prolific in that way.
There was an article that came out on him, I think in 2013, that was describing Criswell as the anti-psychic. You know, saying that every prediction he made had a 100% failure rate, and that it was such an unusual thing that he was getting things so incredibly wrong. And that became a little bit of, you know, common knowledge after that article came out. So it was fascinating to see some of the amazing hits that he got within your book.
Yeah, he, in a general way, he got some right, you know, changing from cash money, coins and bills, to electronic means of financial things. And the thing is, a lot of his predictions were general. And if you throw out tens of thousands of things, one or two might stick.
There's the Ronald Reagan becoming governor was one of the large ones that shocked people, because that was on the Johnny Carson show that he said that, I think.
He claimed that he said that on the Johnny Carson show. The episode, I believe I found the episode that he claims that was on and watched it, which there's very few of those that still exist either. And he doesn't mention it. So, and a lot of his, the text on his books were kind of post-context. He would say, yes, I did predict that JFK wouldn't run for president because of something that would happen to him in November, you know, a year or two after it happened. So it's kind of easy to get a prediction right post-context.
Oh, definitely. That would be far easier than predicting something.
Correct. Yeah.
He didn't exactly claim to be psychic, though. You know, that's something that's been more attributed to him after the fact. Could you explain that?
He claimed that as a child that he had these abilities, that he would be able to tell who was going to be the next customer at the at the funeral parlor, at the mortuary, and things like that, predicted a huge tornado, things like that. But then he claims that he lost that ability when he started making money for it. So probably, I would guess, around the time he started his newspaper columns and was getting paid, you know, a dollar a column or something, he was making money, and that's when he lost it, he claims.
But Mae West certainly believed in him.
Yes, she did. She was really big into the spiritualism, astrology, mysticism, and things like that, past lives and things. So, and supposedly they met in New York City, claimed that he was her press agent for a while in New York, and then they met up again in Hollywood.
Yeah, I was surprised by how close a relationship they had for such a long time. I thought that a lot of the interviews about how she acted with him were very interesting.
Yeah, she sold him her Cadillac limo for a dollar. said, "Hey, bring a dollar over here," and then his her attorney signed it over to him, and he kept that limo up until he passed away in 1982. Yeah, and then she would send food over for him as well via her chauffeur, and you know, some of the she would show up there at the apartments where he lived as well at times. So they were very close for a while.
Yeah, and she wrote that wonderful song about him too.
Yes, she did. She wrote the song Criswell Predicts.
Which is easily discoverable on any streaming service now and well worth a listen.
Oh yeah, it's great. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting. And then he had some wonderful predictions about her being president and going to space.
Yeah, he predicted that she would be the first female president of the United States, mid-60s, about 65, I think is when he said it would happen. And then one of her first orders of business would be to go to the moon. And him and George Liberace would accompany her to the moon.
I want to live in that future. I think that's fantastic. Yeah. You know, there was a certain optimism that seems to go through a lot of his predictions, where he's viewing this utopian world, you know, within his mind, where women have a lot of power and, you know, a lot of the social constraints that existed are no longer a thing. And that is not exactly what I would have expected for any sort of predictions, because so many of the ones nowadays are doom and gloom.
Right. He did love women. He adored women. He, you know, kind of was predicting women's liberation, things like that, that would happen. And let women run the world for a while, because men have, you know, not done such a great job. And so he's very supportive of that.
Yeah, I just thought that was interesting. And it started to fall into place for me when reading about his association with the 50s UFO movement, because that contactee movement tended to have very you know, progressive views of the future, you know, very positive views about how things that were not so much happening then, you know, like women's liberation, you know, equality, environmentalism, you know, as well, were the way of the future, that the aliens were contacting us, you know, to tell us this. So it seems like some of that rubbed off on Criswell, particularly Orfeo Angelucci.
Yeah, definitely. I think that, you know, he was interested in anything like that, any type of different new movement looking forward. He got involved with the UFO, early UFO movement. They had the first UFO flying saucer convention in Hollywood at the Hollywood Hotel where he lived for a while. And then they eventually moved it out to Giant Rock in Landers, California. And Criswell predicted that's where World War III would begin. And then also that's where the first contact with aliens would be as well. And there was a landing strip out there.
Might still happen.
It could still happen. It could, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I go out there every once in a while just to see, you know.
Yeah, I got to check on it.
Yeah, check it out.
Criswell seems to be a big believer in Ed Wood's movies. Not quite enough to invest, but enough to champion them.
Yes, I think him and Ed Wood, they kind of worked each other. Ed, you know, used Criswell's relative fame. Criswell saw Ed Wood's films as another step towards fame as well. And they were close in that way, for sure.
It was fantastic being able to look up online, you know, different clips from like Orgy of the Dead and some of the other productions. I am fascinated by, you know, what a strong afterlife these movies are having when they didn't do particularly well within their own life. What do you think the appeal of them is now?
You know, that's a great question. I wasn't prepared for that one. Of course, you know, the Ed Wood films are, you know, championed because of he was a diehard filmmaker. He just wanted to make movies and, you know, kind of a, you know, ode to the guy that just does whatever he can to make his movie. That's one appeal of him. I think it's just a nostalgia as well. And just looking back at other, you know, how things were done. And sorry, that wasn't a very good answer.
Well, I mean, I think that you're right, though. Like, there strikes me as being an almost blind optimism, you know, within a lot of Ed Wood's productions where he firmly believes within this vision and he's going to do what it takes to actually make it happen. So for a lot of, you know, younger filmmakers, that's kind of how it goes.
Sure.
You're not going to have a big budget. You're just going to be doing what you're doing. And, you know, as big an appeal as they have within like the Mystery Science Theater 3000 crowd, you know, there is a certain affection for how hard everybody is trying.
For sure. Yeah. And it is inspiring. It is like, you know, if you have this vision, go for it. You know, don't let anybody, you know, tell you can't do it. And if it doesn't turn out so great, you know, you learn a lot from it.
Yeah. And you can just go right on to the next one.
And just keep on going. Yep. Mm-hmm.
It also is, you know, fun to get to see Bela Lugosi just, you know, for the sake of getting to see him, or, you know, getting to see Vampira, who's always flawless. But, yeah, there's such a fun cast of characters.
Yes, they are. They were definitely kind of the left of center part of Hollywood, for sure.
And I think that, you know, them being, you know, a bit of the misfits, a bit of the outcast, is something that, you know, appeals a lot to people, because that's easier to relate to for a certain crowd than, you know, the mainstream.
For sure. Yep.
I was fascinated to learn about the Church of Ed Wood. That was not something that I'd come across before.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, it was basically an internet church established back in the early 90s, I believe, mid 90s maybe, where Ed Wood was just the deity of this religion. Criswell was a saint. Vampira was a saint, I believe, as well. There was an ordained minister, and they would baptize people in the name of the Church of Ed Wood. They had a couple events of screenings of Plan 9 and some other Ed Wood films as well. I don't know if I haven't looked at it in a long time, but I think if maybe you use a Wayback Machine on the internet, you might be able to find their manifests and all that on it.
That would be fantastic. Mm-hmm. It just was such a fun idea, and I can definitely see how that would be something that would take off.
Yeah, it was pretty popular there for a while, for sure.
Did you get to meet anybody who was part of it?
Not in person. I corresponded with a few people that were involved with it, and very helpful. And, you know, great information on Ed Wood. Just it certainly gives a different angle on Ed Wood.
Yeah. So what did you make, you know, after you're doing this much research, you know, what did you make of Halo Meadows?
Yeah, she was quite interesting, probably just as eccentric as Criswell. I think they were a good pair in that way. They did work well together. They had big dreams together. She came from a fairly well-off family back east, which helped support them along the way. She and certainly her own mind and her own belief system.
Yeah, I thought it was almost endearing, you know, how when she did end up going back east, people were so protective of her that she became, you know, just a bit of a staple of the neighborhood. But, you know, they weren't wanting her to be used in any way.
Right. Yeah, they were protective of her. Some of the people there where she was from, Littleston. And it's a great tribute to her legacy that things that they've done there and her remembrance and things like that. And,
you know, it was interesting to me. You spoke well saying that they were, you know, good for each other with, you know, the similar eccentricities. But, you know, things definitely seems to fall apart for the two of them. And I was, you know, almost curious about just what happened.
Halo did have some mental issues. She had been committed a couple of times. Criswell had her committed a couple of times. But one of the reasons she left Hollywood and left Criswell there was that her father passed away. And so she went back to take care of their inheritance and the home, the family home she had grown up in and everything. And then that's when she legally separated and divorced Criswell shortly after that. And she had probably, she felt that that maybe she had been wronged, that he had, you know, used her money and things like that to, you know, reach his, try to strive for his stardom and then not really bring her along, maybe.
What do you think that Criswell's legacy is now?
Well, he made things up. He just made up whatever he wanted. And that was not as common back then as it is now, as far as saying you're successful, you know, a Broadway hit, even though you've never been a Broadway hit, or even, you know, just making predictions and things like that, and just making it up as he went along. It was kind of early, innocent, you know, like tabloid news, things like that, which, you know, now that's out of control as far as alternate facts and conspiracy theories, and people just make things up as they go along constantly now. There's no fact checking in most anything. But so he was kind of a start of that, I think, but along with not just him, but others as well.
Do you think that he believed any of what he was saying or thought that what he was doing was helping people?
I think so. I think he definitely had that kind of attitude that he wanted to help people and be generous and help guide people along for their good. You know, I don't think he was just out there just to rip people off.
Yeah, that was the impression that I was getting too, you know, especially with his end of the world party, posthumous birthday party. Like, it, I don't think that if he was just there to rip people off, people would have such a, you know, fond and protective view of him.
No, that's true. And from everything that I've, you know, everybody I interviewed and things like that, he was just a kind and generous man, outgoing. I think as far as his believing what he said, I think he kind of had the attitude as if you believe it, everyone else will believe it, no matter if you just made it up. You know, you put it out there as the truth and people take it that way.
Yeah, those Johnny Carson appearances definitely lend itself to that. You know, with him being such a staunch promoter of what he's saying.
Yeah, he would read it like it's just matter of fact, and then Johnny would make a joke and, you know, make a joke of it or make a joke about him, but it didn't deter him at all. He just kept on going and go on to the next little 3x5 card and read the next predictions like it's absolutely the truth.
God, I have to admire that. Yeah,
it's a lot of conviction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that level of just professionalism as well. You know, of just I'm not going to be, you know, flustered in the least. Just, this is what it is, and
right.
You know, make of it what you will. Like,
mm-hmm.
And he definitely was, you know, an intelligent man too.
Yeah, he was well read. He would read newspapers, anything he could get his hands on, I believe, just to gather information. And that's one of the things he said is his predictions were based on past facts and precedents and things like that. So there was some basis in, you know, history in his predictions.
He's such a fascinating figure, and I'm really excited that more people are going to be able to, you know, learn about him and learn about who he actually was beyond the figure that he has been presented in the Ed Wood movies. What was the most surprising thing to you in researching him?
Man, probably just that conviction of he was Criswell all the time. It wasn't just an act that he put on. You know, he didn't just put on the pancake makeup and get the spit curl going and, you know, showtime. He lived it all the time. He was, you know, Criswell at all times. And just to have that much conviction to pull that off was pretty fascinating to me.
I loved the idea of him going down to the Brown Derby and just being able to walk in the door and there's Criswell.
Right. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. Full pancake makeup straight from the studio.
Do you think that were he, you know, doing his thing now, like were he around today, do you think that he would have a greater level of fame than he achieved back then?
Probably not. I think he probably, you know, if somebody started doing this now, it would just be mixed in the wash of everything else. You know, there's plenty of people spouting off untruths now that something like this would just probably, you know, get lost in the whole mix of it. I think he, you know, was a product of mass media at the time with the newspapers and radio and television, early television, which, you know, that opportunity no longer exists to get into something that early and become a bit of it, you know, in that way.
That's an interesting perspective because I think that he has, you know, such a fantastic presence, but, you know, you're right that wouldn't necessarily, you know, fly. Like there are just so many people now doing their
right.
own thing.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's just absolutely amazing. So, you know, with the new information that you're getting and, you know, with the possibility of new things being uncovered in time, you know, do you think that you'll be able to present some of that material, you know, to the world?
I will at some point. I'm not sure what form that'll come in. Could be a, you know, revised edition of the book, something like that, considering that. But at some point it'll get out there, the new information.
Yeah, that's excellent. So how do people find you online? You know, how can people follow you?
Social media, Facebook, Forbidden Predictions, at Forbidden Predictions. Instagram is at Forbidden Predictions as well. And Twitter, at Forbidden Prediction 1, something like that's the short handle. But if you just search Forbidden Predictions, you'll find it there.
Is there anything new that you're working on, or are you resting after the long research?
I'm working on a few things. I have some things in the works. One of them is about one of the people that is in the book, John Gilmore. He was a writer. He wrote a book called Laid Bare about with a lot of Hollywood exploitative type stories in there that he claims to have been involved in. So that's one project I'm working on. He's kind of the same as Criswell as far as he made a lot of things up from what I've discovered. Claims he had sex with James Dean, you know, things like that.
Okay.
So, So that's one project I'm working on.
Oh, that's excellent. Yeah, there's something so fun about, you know, digging into these characters and just what was going on.
Yeah, it is fascinating. I've become really more fascinated with it, you know, over the Criswell research of other writers. There's a guy named Leo Guild that wrote a bunch of exploitive novels and things about celebrities. And of course, Kenneth Anger, who passed away recently with Hollywood Babylon and things. Yeah, those people really fascinate me.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I'm going to be following and eagerly anticipating your next project.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Okay.
Edwin Lee Canfield's meticulously researched book on Criswell is available from all good bookshops, providing the latest print run hasn't sold out as the first one did. And you can read our review of it on the Folklore Podcast website. You'll find a link on the episode page for this episode or in the book reviews tab on the top of the site. As an audiobook producer, I've had the pleasure of working on many varied genres and styles of book, and, as coincidence would have it, one of these features Criswell in a lead role. The Vampire's Tomb Mystery by Dwight Kemper is a rollicking murder mystery based in 1950s Hollywood and centred on many actual historical events, although it recasts Bela Lugosi into the fictional Armand Tesla. Armand Tesla was to be buried in his vampire costume, but obviously the aged star of stage and screen horror was not yet ready to ring down the final curtain. No, it would not be nearly so easy to bury such a restless corpse. In the Vampire's Tomb Mystery, the reader should be prepared for a case of a body that won't stay put, and the tale of a struggling young movie director with more ambition than talent, who turns up missing at the vampire's last bow. It will prove to be just the kind of case that only a psychic Hollywood detective like Charles Criswell King, aided by famous monster Forrest J. Ackerman, can solve. To link in with this episode, we've been able to make the audiobook of the Vampire's Tomb Mystery available for download via the podcast web store in the audiobook section. Here's an extract of the book to give you an idea.
It was a strange sight, an antique limousine pulling up to a curb in the Nickel, a quaint euphemism for LA's Skid Row, so named because it centred on Fifth Street. The Nickel was notorious for its prostitutes, derelicts, and dope addicts. It was Nightmare Alley in a dream factory town. Wood gestured at a shabby apartment house set starkly against the incongruous backdrop of blue skies and the Hollywood Hills. "Do you really think she'll come?" "I hope so," Criswell said. "Mailer could use a night out." He turned to Wood. "Aren't you going to open that?" Wood looked down at the pot in his lap. "You said I couldn't have any." "I meant the envelope in your pocket." "Oh, that," Wood smiled nervously. "I'm afraid to. Armand sounded so crazy. There's no telling what's in it." Criswell shrugged. "We'll never know until you open it." Wood reached for the envelope, hesitated, then shook his head. "Maybe later. I'm not ready yet." "If you wait too long, a mysterious stranger is liable to plug you and take it from you. Don't even joke about a thing like that." Wood looked around anxiously. "You were joking, right?" "Of course I was. I hate to say this, but I think Armand might be turning paranoid in his old age." "Could we stop talking about this?" Wood pleaded. "Okay," Criswell said, opening the door. "Let's see if Mailer is in a party mood." Mailer Nermy was definitely not in a party mood. She was sitting at her kitchen table, her angular features sans makeup, naked except for a mousy grey bathrobe cinched tightly around her waspish waist. She felt decidedly unglamorous, having taken a pair of scissors to her red hair during a fit of despair. As she smoked a cigarette and sipped her whiskey from her Vampira glass, she tried to figure out how she'd gone from being the toast of late-night television, with featured articles in Life magazine and Newsweek, to down-and-out divorcee, barely eking out an existence on $13 a week. With her TV career in the toilet, what was left? Moving back in with her mother? Modeling for some sleazy camera club? Hustling for tips as a waitress? Of course, there was always the other alternative, becoming a hooker. When you got right down to it, was there really any difference between show business and prostitution? Then there was the other alternative, working for Edward D. Wood Jr. The thought of appearing in an Edward D. Wood Jr. production made Mela's skin crawl. Her gaze drifted to a framed picture of her vampira persona. A fully costumed Armand Tesla stood behind her, feasting hungrily upon her neck. Vampira was in ecstasy as the Count supped upon her throat, while her left boob got a reach-around squeeze from the naughty old lech. Vampira's hand rested over Tesla's bony, clutching claw, pressing it closer to her breast, inviting him to squeeze it tighter. She raised her glass in mocking toast as she remembered his hot breath on her neck.
"To Vampira and Dracula,"
she said.
"Here's hoping we both eventually rest in peace."
As she drank to her toast, Mela saw distorted in the bottom of her glass the beckoning image of her kitchen stove. She wondered just how long it would take for the gas to asphyxiate her. Then she remembered she hadn't paid her utility bills, and the gas had been turned off.
"I can't even afford to kill myself,"
she sighed, smirking wistfully. A knock at the door made Mela tense. Back in January, the actress had been the victim of an attempted rape. Provocative photos of Mela displaying bruises on her shoulder and upper thigh were circulated in the press. Sadly, the resulting publicity did nothing to resuscitate her career. The knocks rapped out, shave and a haircut. Snuffing out her cigarette, Mela eyed the door warily as she sprang to her feet and grabbed the baseball bat she kept by the door.
"Who is it?"
she challenged, Louisville Slugger at the ready.
"Criswell!"
sang a familiar, friendly voice.
If you are a Patreon supporter of the podcast at the appropriate levels, you can use your shop discount code for a reduction on the price of the Vampire's Tomb mystery if you fancy a copy. Don't forget that you can join Patreon and support us for as little as £1 a month and get exclusive content and other rewards, as well as helping to secure the future of the podcast. And finally, just as this episode was being prepared, news came out of the death of William Friedkin, director of the iconic horror movie The Exorcist. In memoriam of Friedkin's work, we're bringing forward the release of a scheduled future episode of the podcast discussing the legacy of The Exorcist. Keep an eye out for that in the feed very soon. In the meantime, thanks for listening, and see you next time.